Hey, it's Glenn Thrush with Politico's weekly podcast. This week we talked to Nicole Wallace, who seems to be everywhere. You have an electronic device. She's on The View. She's on MSNBC as a contributor. And she just has a new book out, Madam President, which is premised on the potentially likely scenario that we have a female president, a female chief of staff, and a female secretary of state. Oh, yeah, and a female secretary of defense. But Nicole and I talked about 2016 a lot. She used to work for Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush was one of the first people she worked for. Then she went on to work for George W. Bush as a communications director in the White House. And she had some really interesting things to say about female candidates, particularly about Carly Fiorina's recent attacks on Hillary Clinton. Nicole didn't like that. So here's Nicole Wallace. What people do not realize is what a dump the place is. Like, at least in the press, having been in like lower, you know, like where we are, even on the first floor, but in the basement particularly.
Of the White House?
Oh, my God.
Well, the OEO, yeah. I mean, I think what people don't realize about the White House is that when you move in, it's like it happens in one day. So I don't know if you've ever, like, I mean, think about moving into your first apartment.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the movement, it was not, you couldn't sleep there the first couple of nights because you were still decontaminating. So moving into the OEOB, I'm sure the West Wing is in better condition.
Oh, so you were in the,
Which
is a much nicer place to work.
Well, it's bigger.
Yeah.
But they leave it in greater disrepair during the change between one president and the other, especially if they're of different parties. So.
Well, we had flooding down the basement and in, they had to rip out the carpet twice and we were enjoined from working down there for about 6 days because they thought there was a real serious toxic mold problem.
But I don't think they really, I think the toxic mold isn't about concerns for us. It's about concerns
litigation
for the historic buildings.
Yeah. You can tell. They were expendable, right? And then the other thing is like the vent, you know, like the, I remember like my big jihad was like, let's get a better vending machine. Two better vending machines upstairs.
It's like running for high school student body president. Like,
the
let's
whole
fix the small stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about your book. It's pretty interesting that you're imagining a female president. How much of a suspension of disbelief is the potential in 2016 for an actual female president?
Well, listen, Hillary Clinton has as good a shot as anybody sitting here, you and I, you know, this far out. I mean, I think the reason politics is an addiction for me and for, I would guess, most people on this floor is because it's the greatest reality show on earth. Anything can happen. Howard Dean can scream and sink himself in a minute. Mike Huckabee can keep on keeping on and you know, to the consternation of John McCain. You know, Rick Santorum can win primaries and recounts. Hillary Clinton can be dethroned by a young upstart from Chicago, Illinois. Anything can always happen. It's what makes it riveting. It's what makes it thrilling. And I think we'd be remiss to forget that these are human beings. So truly anything can happen. Could Hillary Clinton be the first woman president? Sure. It's possible. I don't think, though, that the fantasy that I write about in the books will be realized until we're talking about a couple women on, you know, I think we have like 12 or 13, 14 people running on the right. One of them is a woman. I don't think my fantasy will be realized until two or three of them are a woman, and we're talking about the prospect of a woman running against a woman.
Well, let's jump right into that. You know, there have not been a wealth of viable female candidates on either side of the ball, but clearly Hillary has emerged as clearly the historically the most viable mm-hmm. female candidate. Mm-hmm. What do you think it is about your party at the moment that makes only a Carly Fiorina jump in? I mean, mm-hmm. we're talking about 8% of the field now is mm-hmm. female on the Republican
yeah.
side, right?
Yeah, and to not take anything away from Carly, because I think she's very talented and very smart, but she's viewed as a long shot at best. I mean, at this point, her role in the Republican field has been to be the most sort of strident critic of Hillary Clinton's, which is interesting to me as well. Why is that fall to a woman?
Which, by the way, Hillary did not do when requested explicitly by Obama's staff against Sarah Palin. You remember
right,
that.
Right, right. And neither did Sarah Palin right. against Hillary Clinton. I stood there when Charlie Gibson asked her on her front porch in Wasilla staring at that lake, and she had nothing but high praise for Hillary Clinton. So I think some women feel checked by that, and some women feel, you know, that shouldn't hold me back. And I wouldn't judge either approach, but it all fascinates me because, at least in the Republican Party, you rise to be a viable candidate for the presidency, you know, one of three ways, either through business, as Meg Whitman tried to do, as Carly Fiorina is attempting to do, through the governorship, so someone like Nikki Haley would do, as Susana Martinez would do. Or, you know, it's never been done before, but I suppose you could make the leap from the U.S. Senate. And in none of the three training grounds, if you will, are there ample women rising to the top. So we have a more structural...
With the exception of Patty Murray, I think would be somebody who I would think is probably the strongest, the most empowered, right? Patty Murray and Pelosi, obviously, on the...
Yeah, and I think... And I think, you know, the path is a little different on the Democratic side. You know, you have more women in local government. You have more women that sort of are rising up to powerful positions in the House, like Nancy, you know, like you're saying. But just looking at our side, we have a long way to go before we're treating each three of those sort of training grounds as real opportunities to push a woman to the top.
Let me jump back on the Carly thing, because I thought that point was really interesting. Obviously, Reagan had, what was it? What commandment was? I forgot. The thou shalt not attack another Republican.
Right.
Do you think Carly should stick to create a certain kind of new commandment and be a little more cognizant of her role as a gender pioneer in her own party?
You know, I don't want to be, you know, the chick police, but I think that Carly will go far by broadening the attack to everything that's wrong with a liberal approach, as opposed to being the thorn in Hillary Clinton's side. Because I think that she runs the risk of having it look personal. And I think Carly can set herself apart in a lot of ways. She's worked in tech. I think Republicans are going to need to fine-tune their economic message with unemployment falling to 5.4%.
It is something today.
It can't just be a broad, you know, lower. I mean, it's going to have to be smarter than what it needed to be, frankly, 4 years ago. So I think Carly is in a unique position to sort of hone the Republican economic message, to hone a good, effective, clear, and specific message about opportunity inequality, something that Chris Christie talks about. Carly could flesh out what that looks like. And I just think those are better messages for her to carry, but it's certainly up to her if she thinks she's found her niche as the number one Hillary Clinton critic. I'm sure she'll get a lot of attention
and
for doing so.
And Huckabee talks about the economic equality issue sort of opaquely. Walker a little less opaquely. Let's talk about somebody you work for. I will throw a little bit of my skin in the game here. I think it's a little bit crazy that Jeb is waiting as long as he has to announce. Granted, we have a story out today that talks about how he wants to lard as much money into that super PAC as possible before he jumps. But doesn't that kind of run the risk of him not articulating a vision for himself? He's at 5% in Iowa right now, only a couple of points up on Rubio in New Hampshire. What do you think he needs to do as a candidate with voters as opposed to donors?
Well, I've been in the room with Jeb Bush, with his Florida constituents. I was 25 years old, and it's when I fell in love with politics, and it's when I fell in love with Jeb Bush. We were at an event with parents and families of special needs kids in the Florida public school system, and he was specific. He was proactive. He was empathetic. He was everything you would want in a leader, and seeing him in a room with his constituents made so clear why he had won as governor of Florida. And
the one thing I would say about that, the description you gave me is exactly what Hillary's people say about Hillary as a candidate.
Well, and maybe, listen, and I hope that her followers believe in her as much. You know, I hope that you're always working for someone feel that way about.
I'm just saying.
Right? I hope that.
But it's just interesting to me that they track so closely.
Well, and I think that some of their strengths are parallel. I mean, some of their strengths are on the policy side, not the retail political side.
Oh, interesting.
I think some of their strengths are in a room, not on a stage. So I think they have some similar strengths. I think they would be very interesting opponents in a general election. I think it's lame when people like me who live in New York and, you know, talk on TV, try to predict the outcome of a primary.
You gotta stop beating up New York.
Before anyone's, listen, I love New York, but I know how lame it feels if you live in Nevada or Iowa and you haven't even had a chance to meet all these guys and you hear some tool in Manhattan saying what they think is going to happen. I mean, I try not to do it, but I think Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush have some similar assets as leaders and as people who make policy and sift through policy. I think they have some of the same weaknesses too. They're both in a constituent free zone. Neither of them represents anybody right now. Neither of them is advocating on anyone's behalf except their own campaigns. Right. And I think it's awkward, frankly, for both of them.
Absolutely. I mean, do you think it would be wise for him to just jump into the pool at
this
point?
Yeah, what is it? I mean, it's like being at a horse race and like your horse isn't at the gate yet. Yeah, I wish he would.
It's a weird feeling. And I think also you get into donors. I've seen this with a lot of candidates. You get into kind of a donor speak mode. It's like a different part of your brain almost trying to make that appeal.
Jeb will be better when he's in those rooms.
Does he warm up? I mean, like, the thing about, and I covered Hillary from really too damn long, actually, from 05, her reelect in the Senate straight through her the baton death march of 08. And, you know, she has the longest runway of any candidate I've ever covered.
Mm-hmm.
It takes her a long time to kind of get warmed up.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny to me, and I'm actually writing about it this week, is people were bitching about how she was sitting off to the sideline. She was in the presidential suite. Well, in the last month, she's actually been out there. Jeb has not been out there in the same way that Hillary has.
Yeah, I think that the risk is that, you know, let's face it, we don't matter. But the people who live in New Hampshire and Iowa and South Carolina and Florida and Michigan matter a lot.
Yep.
And I'm not sure that they're not forming some opinions about the others or getting more interested in hearing from the others. So he has to at least keep them as interested in him as in the others. And he has to, like you said at the beginning, to find himself before someone else defines him. There's still plenty of time, but you can't, like you said, you can't wait forever.
No. And you're talking about sort of the economic message. It seems to me like any candidate that comes up with sort of a compelling way to articulate that, not even necessarily a specific plan, but really sort of catches the mood of the country. And the mood of the country is really enigmatic. It's like, and it also seems really kind of fragmented, right?
I mean, totally fragmented. And let me tell you something. No one is going to win on either side this time by playing to the polls. You know, you can't, not the opinion polls, but the polarized caps. I mean, you cannot ignore, I mean, when you've got John Boehner on Meet the Press saying, of course, there's a problem in the African-American community doesn't trust the police
put
in
on
America.
Body cameras, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you cannot ignore.
World's changing.
I dealt with this in the White House when, in 2005, a lot of the messages about the Iraq war were, you know, we're winning. But people turned on the TV and they saw the Samara Mosque burn. They saw Iraq in flames.
Right.
And when the message doesn't match the picture, when the message doesn't match what people see and hear, you almost run the risk of people, you know, tuning you out. So the Republican message has to acknowledge what people are seeing, which is a great disparity between the people for whom this economy has worked and the people who have sort of been left behind. Republicans can't write off any part of the country, and they should try to speak to everybody.
Well, it goes back. I mean, was it the famous Matthew Dowd memo that sort of talked about there is no, was that in 04, I think, where it was like, there is no middle. This is, we have to just play to the base. And 2012, having covered the Obama campaign in 2012, that was totally, it was all about the base, to coin a phrase, right? So you think this is, and I totally agree with you, but you think we're moving back into a more traditional environment where the candidate's got to pivot to the middle?
Well, and not because there's so, I do think there are a lot of people up for grabs, but I think we are looking at sort of a lot of nationalized stories. I mean, I think Baltimore became a nationalized story, and I think that, you know, the economy with unemployment at 5.4% and some people still feeling left behind, the economy is a nationalized story. It was a regional story in 2004. You had the Midwest where manufacturing jobs had, you know, it was still regional messaging. I think that a lot of the economic message has to be speaking to everybody. I think a lot of the problems in the city have spilled out. They have spilled over. I mean,
well, poverty is a suburban phenomenon. I mean, the demographic.
Manchin said his number one issue is prescription drug abuse. I mean, we can't sort of have stuff that they talk about in Washington and stuff that you talk about in the campaign.
Well, I was on MSNBC with Manchin a couple of days ago, and we were talking about the Clinton Foundation, and he surprised the hell out of me by saying, my big problem with the Clinton Foundation is not who they're taking their money from. It's like, why the hell aren't they putting money into West Virginia?
And, you know, I think I've made enemies in my own party, in the Democratic Party, in the media by saying that the Clinton stuff doesn't matter. It's not that it doesn't matter because it is not egregious. It is. It doesn't matter because no one thinks more of them than that. No one thinks they don't do shady things, but it's like the cake has been put in the oven. It's cooked for 40 minutes. It rose. It's on the counter
already.
It's
there. That's right.
You can't change the cake.
It's the road you're riding on.
That's
right.
It's the Clinton cake. It's what's in it. It's what people know is in it, and they eat it anyway.
Now, granted, if you open up that cake and you find a hacksaw in there, things do change.
Not for the Clintons. Not for the Clintons.
You think they could survive anything?
I think that nothing surprises people about the Clintons.
What is the one? Well, this is a dangerous hypothetical. What is the one thing, one revelation that could come out in the next 6 months that could sink her? Is there anything?
On a serious level, if it ever came out that she and the Obama White House really, really hated each other, I think that would confound a lot of Democrats.
Well, she's got a big, I mean, that seems to be a big issue on anything. Look at her on the immigration stuff a couple of days ago, where she was clearly attempting to sort of deepen and differentiate herself from Obama. And I will tell you, I got a couple of emails from White House people who were none too happy. And they know, and by the way, that is the leverage that he is going to have in the last 18 months is the knowledge that she knows that if African-American voters in the inner cities in this country perceive her as bucking him, she's in big trouble.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, one of the things I thought in one of the interviews I saw you talk about was talking about a female chief of staff, which to me is actually more interesting than a female president, right?
Because I know I'm in Washington,
yeah,
right?
Right.
Because why on earth? I mean, George W. Bush had Karen Hughes, Mary Madeline, Margaret Tutwiler, Margaret Spellings, Harriet, there were tons of powerful women. It was the closest I came to living in a parallel reality where the women ran everything. Yet no woman chief of staff.
You could totally argue that the Bush White House, the W White House, was the most female empowering administration in history.
It was the most female empowered place I've ever worked.
So Obama, no one would make that argument about the Obama White House, by the way.
Or the McCain campaign, which was another political organization where I was. Other than Carly, who was at in some sort of strategic meeting, I was always the only woman at the table.
Okay, but since you want to dump on New York, I am from New York, and I will.
I love New York.
I will tell you, it is my feeling. I never had issues in New York with female superiors. I mean, I never. There was not sort of an office-wide sense in some places that having a woman boss was kind of crazy. Here, it is different, and it gets even worse in the White House. It's a crazy phenomenon. It really does seem like. You're back in the 50s somehow when you walk through those gates over there, right?
Yeah, you're at Sterling Cooper, right?
You know,
you're back in Mad Men era. Which makes Obama's war on women sort of ludicrous, right?
Right.
So I think that I wish that more women would speak out about it when they're in those positions. You know, I'd love to hear Valerie Jarrett explain why and if she's ever been a candidate or wanted to be a candidate to be the White House Chief of Staff, or Susan Rice. I mean, I know both of them. I'm not sure what anyone thinks they're missing to have that job.
No, but I mean, I would say like the person, I would not say Valerie because I don't think her skill set fits it. I would say somebody like Cutter. Stephanie Cutter would be somebody who I think would have potentially... But that's regard. But there's a certain.
But let me just be equal opportunity.
Yeah.
Bush never put any of the powerful women we just named in the post either. So, in my book, the president's a woman, the chief of staff's a woman, the secretary of defense is a woman, because I feel like those are the three touchstones where you won't have sort of arrived at, you know, women taking over the universe until they control the bombs. The planes, and, you know, the free world. So, I mean, I think that part of, you know, people argue about what's a greater fairy tale in the books, whether the fact that she's a moderate with a Democratic vice president, she's a Republican, is more far-fetched, or the fact that women serve as president, chief of staff, and secretary of defense. And I find the whole debate depressing. I think both would be wildly appealing to a lot of Americans.
But the elephant is your party has an issue with women. I mean, it's...
Well, I don't think that's true. I think both parties have an issue putting women in control of certain things.
But in terms of the... Okay, let's talk in terms of the issue base. Just if you're going to do flat-out litmus stuff, and I know this has been litigated to death, but, like, the Democratic Party, I don't know what the what the breakdown was in 2012, but there tends to be a substantial gender gap between the two parties. And I guess the age difference, older
it's
women.
Marriage, actually, that's the
marriage
biggest.
Marriage is the biggest.
So unmarried women overwhelmingly vote for Democrats.
Is there anything from a policy perspective, given the constraints of how conservative the base is now, that Republicans can do to do better with women?
Well, I think you have to start by telling the truth, and the truth is that it's married women who are available to you. I think that a lot of married women are conservative.
So it's kind of the Ashley Madison strategy.
Well, I think a lot. Listen, I think that so much of it is how you talk about these things. I think that you know, I have a 3-year-old. I'm certainly raising my kid to believe that you may not always agree with everybody, but you have to be agreeable. So I think a lot of it is temperament. But that said, I don't think Romney or McCain had temperament problems. So some of it has to also be, you know, not just the package, but the dog food, right? I mean, some of it has to be the substance of it. And I think our party does sometimes struggle on the substance of the social issues. I'm happy to see some evolution on marriage equality. I think women come around on social issues a little faster than men. And I think if you can speak about... Listen, I think whatever party tolerates the more diversity of views, I think if you're the party that tolerates an understanding that some people still believe that marriage is between a man and a woman, and you're the party that accepts and understands that marriage equality is the future, that's what young people believe in, then you're going to have more people with you. If you're the party that doesn't tolerate either one, you're going to have fewer people with you. On abortion, if you're the party that seems to understand that it's deeply personal and you're not going to change anyone's mind, frankly, Sarah Palin on abortion, you know, was at least when I worked for her, knew lots of people who were pro-choice. And she said, I simply made different choices. I mean, I think on the social issues, it's not about manufacturing some path through the mushy middle. Because let's face it, on abortion, there's not much of a middle,
there's
right?
There's no middle at all.
And my book actually starts out with the Republican president giving a speech where she acknowledges that she's a supporter of reproductive freedom. And there's a line where she says, this is the greatest personal fantasy in the whole book, where she says, people who are pro-life are fighting from the most moral part of their belief system to protect the sanctity of life. And people that are pro-choice are fighting from the highest moral center of their being, where they believe that women should have, that it's the ultimate freedom. It's a freedom as vital as the air we breathe and the water we drink. So we have to respect and honor that everyone comes to this fight from their highest moral ground. And we just don't do that.
But the problem is the tone. Tone is everything, and as I will talk in a second about immigration, where tone is king, right? Or Ray. But I think, like, in terms of on the abortion issue, perfect example here is look at sort of the transvaginal ultrasound debate in Virginia, or the Missouri Senate candidate?
Legitimate rape.
The legitimate rape guy. There is a certain element of your party that is very active in the primaries and very active on Twitter and very active in terms of grassroots fundraising that wants to hear the most extreme language.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyone that wants to hear the word transvaginal has got issues for which they should seek therapy. you know...
Was it Tina Fey talked about transvaginal airways?
Anyone, I mean, I most politicians I know really cringe at having to, you know, address these questions. They are so deeply personal and they're intractable, right? I mean, you're not going to convince someone, because most people who are pro-life would march in the streets for the cause, and most people who are pro-choice would march in the streets for their cause. So they're not views that anyone is ambivalent or lukewarm about. And, you know, we were talking about women before. That's why single women are pretty much out of reach. A lot of unmarried women are more interested in reproductive rights than really national security or economic opportunity or anything. So that's part of the problem with speaking to them as Republicans. So, and I understand that, you know, I understand that. I have one of three sisters in my family. I grew up in San Francisco. I understand the passion around that issue. But I think... when you're talking about who's up for grabs and who determines the outcome of presidential elections, we're not talking about those women, right? We're talking about married women. We're talking about the women who in 2004 overwhelmingly voted for George W. Bush over national security issues, who in 2008 overwhelmingly voted for President Obama because they were sick of, you know, everything, and they had sort of lost faith that the wars could be won. In 2012, they, you know, stayed with Obama because they you know, thought that Romney, you know, his comments about the 47% and whatnot. And I think in this campaign, they are very much up for grabs.
So when you sort of look at the field right now, obviously Rubio's had a couple of good, very good weeks, mm-hmm. and the man can speak. Mm-hmm. And the man has that thing that you have been given praise for being able to do, which is to say unpleasant things in a very pleasant mm-hmm. manner. What do you think of Rubio? And in term, if you were sort of still wearing your Jeb Bush hat and you seem to like the guy, mm-hmm. who do you mm-hmm. see as his big threats?
I like Rubio a lot. I think Maureen Dowd wrote a column mocking me because I said I thought it was a political asset that he listened to and liked rap music. But jokes on Maureen, because a study came out this week saying rap music is the most important genre to understand since the 60s music.
Well, if she goes back to Colorado and has one of those weekends in the hotel again, maybe she'll turn around.
Maybe she'll change. So I think Marco is great in that he's of this generation. He is from Miami, which is a place where I think you sort of, you know, I think it's a place where it's got the things that happen in the economy play out in Miami when the country's in recession. Miami's in recession when the country, you know, it's not a part. It's not like Michigan, a part of the country that's sort of been in a specific industry's recession. So I think being from Florida, being from Miami, I think having the history. I read his book. I mean, he's got a great personal story. I think that he has a couple of challenges, as they all do. I mean, a lot of the people who feel that you know, he owes a lot of his current political accomplishments to a guy named Jeb is a little graceless. I personally feel that way, but it wouldn't hold me back from being enthusiastic about him should he be our nominee. And I think that he'll be tested on the trail, as they all will. So we'll see. You know, we'll see how he does in living rooms in Iowa. I think he'll probably do pretty well. Talented
guy. How about Walker? Do you know anything about him?
Well, I think Walker has got such a great story from the real battlefields, the political battlefields in Wisconsin, you know, standing up to the unions, but doing it in a way where he won on substance and lost on style was probably an incredibly valuable lesson for anyone that wants to run for president. So I like him a lot, and I'm really excited to watch him. And again, he looks like a president. He's at a central casting, and he talks sort of the talk of the current political debate.
And everyone's got really good hair, I should say.
They do all have good hair. And it's a field of, you know, wrong Santorum. I mean, they all have good hair.
It's just completely ridiculous, and it's wrong. Let me end on Hillary, as I suspect all of us will end on Hillary. There's been a lot of talk about her chilling out. There was a piece in the Times that I personally didn't agree with, saying that she was willing to take more risks. I think life is a lot easier when you do not have a primary opponent, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Do you see anything changed in her? Do you think she's a stronger, weaker candidate than 08?
You know, I mean, my fictional president is borrowed a lot from Hillary Clinton's stoicism, and it takes a terrorist attack, a day when five cities literally burn, for her to sort of crack her heart open. And in the novel, my fictional president tries to live up to the last guy who had to lead the country through a day like that, who is the real guy that did it, obviously, who I worked for. And her greatest, what she thought got her elected twice, ends up being her greatest challenge when the country needs to see what she's made of. And I think that is a very potentially relevant parallel to Hillary Clinton's journey, where she's thought for so long that being stoic and being strong is the path. I can't really tell if she's been convinced or has arrived at the conclusion that it may not be. I meet Democratic women around Hillary's age all the time who say that they will never support her for standing by Bill Clinton during the Lewinsky and
really,
all the infidelity.
Still.
Democratic women who hate her. I can't relate to that.
Yeah,
I mean,
a marriage is so,
you have no idea what's going on in anyone's marriage. And the fact that she sat there and blamed the right-wing conspiracy, I'm sure that she was looking at a crappy option and a crappier option. And I'm sure she picked what for her was the less crappy option. But that there are Democratic women who can't forgive her for that ties my brain in a
knot.
What's
so interesting, you seem fascinated by Hillary Clinton.
I've read everything written about her. I've read her books. I've read everything written about Margaret Thatcher, too. You know, I've read everything. You know, to imagine a female president and expect people in Washington, D.C. to buy not just this book, but the other two, you have to get the political DNA correct. So I read everything about Margaret Thatcher's marriage, and I read everything about Hillary Clinton's marriage, and there can't be two political partnerships more sort of similar and dissimilar.
Right.
I mean, Dennis Thatcher was almost Hillary Clinton
right.
to Margaret's Bill. And, you know, so they're almost the inverse of those two.
And Margaret Thatcher was much more protean than Hillary Clinton is.
Right.
The one thing you can say about Clinton is she's a fixed point in space and has been for a long time. 25 years. For 25
yeah,
years.
Yeah.
Do you think that she, you talked about, what do you think the odds are that we're really going to see a Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton face to face?
Well, I think it would be good for the country. I mean, I think they're adults. I think at a policy level, they're both too smart to have sort of an inauthentic debate about issues like immigration that we were talking about. And I think they both know what to do with the keys to the West Wing. So I don't think either one would run a 3 a.m. ad, right? I mean, at 3 a.m.,
right.
I think either one of them could handle the phone call.
Right. One last thing, I promised to talk about immigration, which is... I'm sure it's a thrilling topic everyone wants to hear about, but I think it's
the most important policy issue facing the country.
Totally agree with you. And Hillary Clinton came out, I think, very strongly, more strongly than mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. realized the other day. You were a little bit critical of her on this stuff because she kind of dinged the Bushes on this. How do you think that debate's going to play out between those
two? Well, I mean, I think that if you look at George Bush's address to the nation in 2005. I think it was he asked for network time. I think it was on all three networks. I think the words were lifted straight from that. I mean, he called for a pathway to citizenship, and he did so because the only way to get people out of the shadows, which is a concern for a lot of people in national security circles who care about comprehensive immigration reform, not just for the economic reasons and the humanitarian reasons, but also for the security goal of knowing who all is here,
yep.
Say that the only way to inspire full participation is to have an opportunity for pathway to citizenship, get at the end of the line, but at least you get online. So I think it's rooted in sound policy, and I've been in the room when national security folks and border security folks have said that the only way to get the participation of, it's not 11 million, I think most people think it's closer to 15 to 17
yep.
million people who are illegally, is to offer that pathway to citizenship.
But here's what this is going to play out. This is not a policy debate, as you know. So Hillary gets, let's just presume that they face off with each other, right? Hillary's got the position she's got in immigration. She's locked solid with her base.
Mm-hmm.
It may cost her a little bit in the middle, but that's not where she has to play.
Mm-hmm.
A Jeb Bush gets into a race with Hillary Clinton, and he's in for a dime and a dollar on immigration
mm-hmm.
reform. He cannot roll this thing back. He is who he is on
mm-hmm.
this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't he stand a much greater political chance of getting battered on this? When I go out in the country, I got to tell you, when I'm in Ohio and Indiana and those places, that's an issue people are screaming
mm-hmm.
red-faced at you
mm-hmm.
at.
And I think you have to look back at the numbers of Hispanics who voted for George W. Bush. He got 44%
right.
of the Hispanic vote because they understood these issues. McCain, I think, got 26, and Romney got, I think, still double digits, but less than 20, maybe 12%. I think Jeb Bush understanding this issue with a growing population is not just getting right on the policy, but it could have an astounding political outcome. And I don't think that the base is incapable. I think parts of the base are never going to like this. I mean, parts of the base of both bases are never going to like all sorts of things. And it doesn't preclude anyone from, I mean, if that were the case, then we'd have had totally different nominees and totally different people win the White House. So there's Jim Vandehei running around like he runs the place. Oh, he does. Pointing at someone and jumping up and down.
That's Jim Vandehei.
But I think that Jeb Bush, if any politician has the intelligence, the fortitude, and the talent and skill to thread the needle, which is what you have to do on comprehensive immigration reform, make clear that you're going to secure the borders first, so you're only dealing with people who are already in here. You're not leaving the borders open for new illegal immigrants. Getting the workplace enforcement piece right so that you're bringing everybody along and then putting them at the end of the line. I think that's a message that maybe not a majority of the Republican base, but a majority of sort of the people that are available to Republicans can accept.
Okay, well, on that note, it was great talking to you.
Thank you.
And good luck on the book.
Thank you very much.